This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar. And more importantly, today I have the pleasure and the honor of speaking with Dr. Greg Bailey. He's a former reader in Sanskrit and is an honorary research fellow in the School of Languages and Cultures at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. He is a very well-known, established, seasoned scholar in the field of Purana studies, we can say, and we'll be speaking about a brand new translation of a probably lesser known text that is fascinating about the Hindu god Ganesha. Greg, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Raj. Glad to be here.
Yeah, delighted to have you back. So the text that you have translated for the benefit of the English-speaking world is called the Vinayaka Mahatmya. Could you tell us a bit about how you became interested in this text or decided to translate it or how you came across it? What's the backstory of this text?
Okay. I spent 20 years translating the Ganesha Purana. No one had translated any Puranic texts about Ganesha. And I discovered I was working in the library of the École Française Extrême-Orient in 1979. And found there was a manuscript of this particular text. Anyway, to cut a long story short, in the second kanda of the Ganesha Purana, it refers to the Linga Purana, and it also refers to the Vinayaka Mahatmya. And I wondered what this Vinayaka Mahatmya text was. In fact, if it was a real text or something else. So over the years, traveling to India and looking at manuscript collections and catalogues, I discovered, yes, there was a text called the Vinayaka Mahatmya. And so I wondered what this particular text would be like. As we know, Vinayaka is the other very common name of Ganesha. So about 10 or 12 years ago, I managed to acquire some manuscripts of it and also discovered that Nirnayana Sagar, the very big publisher of Sanskrit texts in Mumbai and Pune, had produced an edition in 1930. So I was able to get a Xerox copy of that. And on that basis, I started reading the text. And I had a Sanskrit reading group with students after I retired from La Trobe. So we read a fair bit of the text in that reading group. The Sanskrit's not especially difficult, though in parts of it are. But on that basis, I reworked it and wrote an introduction and tried to contextualize it within the other literature of Ganesha. There is another huge Purana, the Mudgala Purana, which is gigantic, as long as the Mahabharata, and it's quite difficult in parts, and I don't know if anyone will translate that. It deserves to be translated, but whether it'll be done is a different question.
Well, perhaps that's one of the many future projects that you could consider. Let's stay at the 30,000 foot view level for now. Vinayaka Mahatmya. Vinayaka, it's certainly significant, perhaps one could infer it's significant that the text identifies as the Vinayaka Mahatmya. Why is it this particular epithet, do you think?
I don't know. That is an interesting question, Raj. I don't know. And the Ganesha doesn't occur that much in the text. Maybe it's because, perhaps it's because there was an attempt to try and distinguish this aspect of Ganesha from his function of Lord of the Gunas. By the time this text was composed, whenever it was, perhaps 13th, 14th century, Ganesha had become an extremely popular deity in the Hindu pantheon. But I think that, it may be an effort to try and distinguish different aspects of Ganesha from what we find in the Mahapuranas, the large Puranas. Mostly Ganesha, the story of Ganesha is about his beheading when he's a boy, protecting Parvati, and the head being replaced by the head of an elephant. And I think by that time, by the time when specific texts about Ganesha begin to be published, or produced, I should say, he's become a very prominent god. There's over 100 names of Ganesha, 100, there's 1,000, Sahasranama Stotra, 1,000 names, hymn of Ganesha in the Ganesha Purana. But Vinayaka, which we might take as leader or something like that, is very common in the Ganesha Purana as well. And I suspect that whoever composed this text wanted to try and bring out this particular aspect of Ganesha, because we're dealing with a text which is dealing with Ganesha's avatars. So that's not a very good response, but it's a good question, and I think it needs to be studied.
No, it's an excellent response insofar as that it is evidencing a thought process, and it's one that necessitates conjecture, and it may or may not be known among a more general audience, but studying the Puranas requires a great deal of conjecture and deduction, and things aren't laid out in a clear-cut fashion. And so say a word about this entity called Mahatmya, perhaps the meaning in the Mahatmya genre. Sure.
Mahatmya genre is a genre that's really very similar to the Puranic genre. It means glorification or greatness. It comes from the word Mahatman, which is difficult to translate into English. It can mean great self or great, just great. It can often just mean great without the Atman being translated. But the sense of the Mahatmya as a genre, its own genre, is that it attempts to try and focus in on a particular aspect of a deity or of a place of worship, because many Mahatmya is associated with places of worship, or of a particular geographical area. And in doing so, it collects myths and narratives that relate to that particular geographical area or to a particular aspect of a deity or a particular mode of worship. I mean, as you're aware, there are hundreds of Mahatmyas lying around in manuscript libraries in India, most of which have not been studied or translated, and most of which tend to be connected to the Skanda Purana, which is a gigantic text, 6 or 7 volumes in Sanskrit editions, and about 10 in the Motilal translation. But the Mahatmya does allow specialization in one particular area, dealing with one particular topic, and enables the narratives associated with the speciality of the deity or the place, in fact, to be brought together. It's the Sanskrit of the Mahatmya is not particularly difficult. It's usually relatively straightforward, even though most of them, I suspect, were probably recited to a popular audience in a vernacular language. But nonetheless, the fact that it's in Sanskrit still gives it the status of the central of the larger tradition, whilst enabling a range of texts, some of them which are quite humorous, to be brought together to illustrate a particular aspect of a deity or a sacred place.
Typically, listeners probably know that one of my areas of specialty is the Devi Mahatmya, you were kind enough to write a generous foreword for the Devi Mahatmya. But there's, I always translate it just instinctively now as greatness of the goddess. But I mean, really, yep. I mean, it could be glorification, magnanimity, the
narrative of it.
Yeah, sure.
Narrative of the glorification of a goddess, because they are narratives, theological narratives in many respects.
And so these narratives of Vinayaka in this Mahatmya, what are some of the contours or some of the, what's noteworthy about what this text is doing?
What it does, it bounces off the second book of the Ganesha Purana, which partly deals with Ganesha's avatars, but it introduces a few other new ones at the same time. The tale of Chintamani, for example, the first four or five chapters is not found in the Ganesha Purana. So it's a while since I've read the Ganesha. The important point is that we find the word avatara being used continually in this particular text, where you don't find it being used in the Ganesha Purana. And I haven't checked the Mudgala to see, nor do you find it in the story of Ganesha in the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, which I translated for Matala, which came out last year. I'm just looking at the contents now. There's 24 chapters or adhyayas. And it's not focusing so much on the birth of Ganesha, though that does come into play. It focuses much more on the on his descent, into the earth, in order to rectify Dharma in the sense that Krishna does or Devi does in the Devi Mahatmya. It's an attempt to try and place him within this particular framework. We've got to bear in mind that Ganesha, above all, is the creator and destroyer of obstacles, and the notion of the descent or the notion of the avatara is one expression of this destruction of obstacles to a better world. On the other hand, we have to bear in mind that the idea of Ganesha's upbringing, his conflict with Shiva and his closeness to Parvati, is also in the background of this particular text. And you see it in some side stories, various side stories about a woman and a man who've got out into the bush and so forth and had kids. And then there's all sorts of problems associated with that. We also have the development of Ganesha's Vahana, his vehicle and so forth, although it's really about dealing with the peacock. Ganesha rides on a mouse, the mushika, and it's really about that the Ganesha Purana deals. But as you say, the main context really is the setting up of an environment where the normal order of the earth, Dharma, that untranslatable term Dharma, has been overthrown or has been threatened to be overthrown, and then Ganesha, a Vinayaka, is required to ascend. And he's also called Gajanana, he who has the face of an elephant in the text. He's required to descend in order to rectify this particular situation. And there's always a conflict, there's always a battle, which, of course, he always wins and there's boon givings taking place and so forth. And so it's placing Vinayaka or Ganesha within the same kind of framework as the goddess and of Vishnu and to a lesser extent of Shiva. That's what I think the intentionality of it is, because initially, if we can talk about Hinduism developing in the early historical period, say 200 BCE onwards, Ganesha is hardly ever mentioned at all. It's later on that he becomes an important, several hundred years later, does he become an important deity. And I think by the, say, the 1200 or something like that, whenever this, it's impossible to date these texts, as you know. And the earliest manuscripts are usually about 1700. By that particular time, it's clear that there was an effort by Ganesha worshippers, because there are hundreds of Ganesha temples by then, almost institutionalized, to present the deity as a multifaceted deity who performed the same kind of functions as Vishnu and Shiva. And there are places in this particular text in the Ganesha Purana where it declares Ganesha is the same as the neuter Brahman, and that he creates through Brahma, protects through Vishnu, and destroys through Shiva, as we get in the Devi Mahatmya as well.
Perhaps, and this is conjecture, of course, even with the Devi Mahatmya, perhaps it's not dissimilar insofar as there may well have been an ancient following of Durga or Ganesha in this case that was eventually assimilated into the Sanskritic fold. Perhaps the worship of Ganesha long predates.
People have speculated about that, but as you say, it remains pure conjecture. And we really haven't got... There's the odd mention of Ganas and so forth. Ganesha, Lord of the Ganas. The Ganas were the group of young demigods who accompanied Shiva at various places. There's Ganas that are mentioned in the Mahabharata. There's the famous episode of Ganesha's tusk being used to write the Mahabharata, but that's supposed to be much later. We don't find him. We do find the word Vinayaka being used in early Buddhist texts, in Pali texts, but it doesn't refer to Ganesha. So somehow or other, this particular deity, when the mythology of Shiva and Parvati becomes very important, not just of Shiva, but Shiva and Parvati together, in the sense of defining how a Hindu marriage should function and the correct relationship between husband and wife and child, it's then that Ganesha becomes important, because his head's chopped off by his father, and that has to be explained. And the idea of a god with an elephant head and a human body is also difficult, and it's never really resolved in the Ganesha Purana, even though it's referred to, and you get stories there of boys having their heads chopped off and replaced by something else. And it exists behind the scenes in the Vinayaka Mahatmya as well, the same kind of theme, the same kind of concern about the beheading of the child and of the replacement with the elephant head. As I say, that's a real problem. For the text, they did try and deal with it. Rather than just accepting it, they did try and deal with it.
What about this? Certainly this was an organic process of translating this text that occurred in stints over a number of years, but was there anything in particular that surprised you about the text?
Not really, no. It was essentially containing much of the material, or inspired by the what you find in the Ganesha Purana. There is less material in it about the cutting off of the head and so forth. That seems to have been accepted by the time this text was composed. But what I think is the interesting thing about it primarily is the fact that Ganesha has been put up as the Avatara. That's what's interesting. But some of the rest of it occurs, it's taken straight from the Ganesha Purana, and occurs also in the Mudgala Purana. That's what in fact is really interesting. And the fact that a boy like Ganesha, he's still basically a young, he's never depicted as being elderly or anything like that, he's always young, is capable of performing these particular kind of functions that the Avatara performs. The idea of Dharma, I think, is less prominent in this particular text than it is in the Mahabharata, for example, where Krishna is the Avatara, and in the Harivamsa. Because the Puranas are devotional texts, essentially. They're theological and devotional texts. And I think that the more subtle aspects of Dharma, and Dharma is a difficult concept, as we know, tend to be left aside. That's probably the best way to put it in this particular kind of context. So I think the big surprise for me was the fact that here we have a text which is summarizing many of Ganesha's avataras in a way that allows perhaps a recitation or a reading. I think that the Tamil translation, there's a Vinayaka Puranam in Tamil, I think, is based on this. I haven't looked at it closely. It allows a concentrated read of Ganesha's mythology at a time when Ganesha has become a very mature deity and no longer under the sway of Shiva and Parvati, even though they have to be represented because the birth myth is still fundamental. But Ganesha has moved far beyond that by that particular time.
Regarding your observation that the text doesn't contain much discourse on Dharma, would you say that it sets aside that discourse? Would you say that it internalizes it or evidences it in other ways?
I think it probably sets it aside, really. There are places where it's much more crudely developed and so forth, where some kind of demonic figure will come and stop the Brahmins from performing rituals and getting rid of the Vedas and that kind of thing, which you get in the Mahabharata and so forth as well. But I think it sets it aside, because I think that is the composers of a text like this may well have assumed that the kind of arguments about Dharma were already well known to an audience because of the transmission of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, to the two most popular texts in India, even in the present day, and which had long been known in vernacular forms. So they were accessible to a wide audience. So I suspect that the kind of arguments about Dharma, particularly in the Mahabharata, where they become extremely rarefied and scholastic, were completely unnecessary for a popular audience who simply would not have been interested in them. And a text like this is a text for a popular audience. They're almost like soap operas in a way. And you could easily see how this could be adapted for a television series over, say, 25 nights or something like that, because the same kind of themes keep coming out, whereas the Mahabharata in particular, more so than the Ramayana, raises all sorts of questions, deliberately so, because one of the functions of the Mahabharata is to undercut the basic theses that it is pushing. Mm. So I don't know if that's helpful. I'm speculating a lot here.
the questions, the prompts that are issued on this podcast are always meant to be generative. So no, it's great. It's great. A number of thoughts come to mind. I'm trying to decide how nerdy to get in the field of Purana studies. This So you were actually my external examiner for my PhD thesis. I think that was in 2015. And one of the things you pointed out that was worth consideration was what you viewed as the avatar function writ large in the Devi Mahatmya. And I think that's certainly worth consideration. What I equally find fascinating about this text, the Vinayaka Mahatmya, is that unlike the Devi Mahatmya, it's so overt about the avataric function how do you make sense, how can one make sense of the notion that the function of the avatara is considered primarily a Vaishnava or a theological development?
I'm not so sure. I take the point, but I'm not so sure that it is. I think that Shiva
please
has
say
avataras.
More.
I think Shiva has avataras in certain texts, and I think that a number of contemporary swamis have claimed they are avataras of Shiva. Mm. But I agree with you. It does seem to be an essentially a Vaishnava notion, because within the Trimurti concept of creation, preservation, and destruction, the preservation has to be the preservation of a world ordered with a particular cultural view. If we define Dharma as culture, it has to be ordered. And so in that sense, with the systematization of these cosmological functions, cosmogonic and cosmological functions in the Trimurti, then one would expect it to be a Vaishnava concept. Although Brahma, of course, the creator god, he creates Dharma, and he and Vishnu work in conjunction with each other to ensure that Dharma remains as the guiding ethos for the three worlds. I think that because Krishna, the worship of Krishna was so prominent in the early part of the first millennium of the Common Era, it becomes very, very prominent indeed, that the idea of the avatara, the theme of the avatara, in conjunction with its background of Dharma, becomes fundamental for the development of any kind of prominent deity, hence the goddess, who in fact is becoming extremely important, has to be placed within that kind of framework. And much later, Ganesha is placed within it as well. I mean, the Devi Mahatmya is certainly earlier than the Vinayaka Mahatmya. But I mean, I haven't studied the Shiva avataras at all. I'm not sure who has. If Wendy Doniger did, I can't remember. It's a long time since I've read her excellent book on Shiva. But I think that the important point is that, yes, it begins as a Vaishnava concept, but then it becomes a more universalized concept, which any deity that is to be regarded as a supreme deity amongst many other deities, a supreme deity amongst its worshippers, must have some anchorage within the avatara concept. That's how I would argue.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm. Fascinating. In what ways, if any, does the Vinayaka Mahatmya tie itself to or connect to the broader Puranic corpus?
Well, it places itself within the Skanda Purana. That's one particular thing. And the trouble is the Skanda Purana is a catch-all for everything. Because, as you know, so many Mahatmyas, in fact, occur in the Skanda, are attached to the Skanda Purana. And I did check up the Skanda Purana and couldn't find the Vinayaka Mahatmya in it at all. But I think that the production of Puranas became open-ended at a particular time. Yes, the Mahapurana, of which the Skanda is one, many of them became closed canons, as it were, although there are variations in many of the manuscript traditions. But I think that the for some reason, it would have been interesting to see it tied into the Ganesha Purana or the Mudgala Purana, except that the Ganesha Purana is accessible. It's only about 230-odd adhyayas, something like that. The Mudgala Purana is quite inaccessible, and the Ganesha Purana exists in Hindi and Marathi translations and Tamil reworkings as well. The Mudgala does not. But I think that your point that you made earlier about the projection of the name Vinayaka may have prevented it being placed in conjunction with the Ganesha Purana. And I by putting it within the Skanda Purana, it both it places it within the larger framework of the Mahapuranas, whilst at the same time giving it a sense of independence. So I think that that's how we might, in fact, understand that.
What might be your favorite or one of your favorite narratives, your favorite stories within the Purana?
Yes, it's a while since I've read it. I think that I'd have to go through it again to. I'm getting old and my memory is going, but the story of the Chintamani stone from Kapila and so forth, I think is highly significant. That doesn't really occur. That's much more in other texts. It constitutes quite a large part. The killing of Sindura, which occurs in the Ganesha Purana as well. All of these, in fact, are significant. And there are other ones, more personal ones, the narration of chapter 20 onwards, the narration of Sumadha and Madhava, two people who are forced into the forest bush and have a child, and then Ganesha comes along, Vinayaka comes along and helps them out of their problems and so forth. All of these almost personalize the text. And I think that I think is highly significant that the text is so personalized in certain parts. Not all of it. A lot of it is dealing with the three worlds, but much of it is dealing with individual characters, swamis, sages, of course, rishis, and so forth, but also the odd king and the queen. And people who tend to be nonconformists and so forth. And I think that that's quite significant in a text like this, where it occurs less so in the Ganesha Purana, which is still placed very much within the framework of the Shiva Puranas, of the large scale Shaivite Puranas dealing with Ganesha's birth and beheading.
You know, one thought that occurred to me earlier when you were talking about the a popularizability, if that's a word, of these narratives, the serializability, the extent to which this could be a soap opera. I think a phenomenon that evidences that in modern times is the very popular Amarchitra Katha, where these tales are just so they're candy to public audience when packaged properly in a language folks can understand, etc. And I think they may have always functioned in a similar manner in different media throughout the ages.
Yes, I don't know if such comics exist about Ganesha. I mean, there are versions of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana in that particular form. But do you know of any Puranas that have been put into that particular form?
Do you mean in modern times?
Yeah, in that comic form.
Yes, there are stories of there's stories of the Devi Mahatmya, there's stories of the Markandeya Purana. Yeah, there are a number of Puranic narratives that contribute to the Amarchitra Katha series. But whether it's the comic medium or whether it's stage or whether it's, you know, a variety of artistic media, it's just these narratives are sort of crafted for public consumption, it seems, much more so than many of the debates of the Mahabharata, as you mentioned.
Yes, the point about that kind of genre is it allows the text, the classical texts, to be reconfigured in terms of the values of contemporary society. Again, it's like Western soap operas or reality television. Reality television is basically rubbish, except that it develops. It contains important mythological elements, and it interests me insofar as it reflects neoliberal values, and neoliberalism has been a disaster for the world. And I think that reality television in particular inculcates these kind of individualistic, atomistic values in people. And the point about the Puranic narrative is that it can really be, and the Mahabharata narrative, apart from the didactic portions of the Mahabharata, these texts are really accessible at all sorts of different times. They're not frozen in ice, as it were. And I think that the kind of family tensions that are still expressed in the Vinayaka Mahatmya, less so than in the Ganesha Purana, are still relevant in an Indic context at the present time. And so and the same with the Devi Mahatmya, because the Devi is so important in all sorts of forms throughout India and has been for the last 2,000 years, if the truth be known. These texts can easily have a resonance in a popular audience that has no interest in Dharma Shastra or the questioning of the validity of Dharma as an abstract set of concepts defining culture.
Yeah, just fascinating corollary in some of my other work. I've aside from the couple of academic books, I have a popular book out called The Stories Behind the Poses. And so it's narrating vignettes from, you know, the Puranas, the epics, in such a way that folks enjoy them either as stories, but many an astute yoga teacher or, Indology aficionado will reach out and make connections between the narratives and the philosophy, and the narratives and the theology will make overt connections. And I think in many ways, narrative does the heavy lifting of theology and philosophy, but in an accessible way. And I really like and value the point you make about, the text is on the tongue, the Puranas aren't, the genre is not frozen. It's meant to be recapitulated and embellished and sort of rendered for different audiences at different times. I think that's part of the nature of the genre.
I think that what you say just then inspires me to think that looking at the three or four main texts dealing with Ganesha in Sanskrit, the Mudgala Purana represents the heavy, heavy philosophical grounding of this particular deity. As I say, it's extremely long, and there's a lot of very difficult Sanskrit in it. I only read bits and pieces that related to the Ganesha Purana. And that really is... it has been edited by Niranaya Sagar, but it's beyond the capacity of most Ganesha devotees to be concerned. The Ganesha Purana is much more accessible because it's essentially about myth. Yes, it does contain some material about performance of puja, this kind of thing, as Puranas do, as they're required to do because they're devotional texts. And then, so that's a sort of a middle concession, if you like. And the Ganesha Purana has been recited. I've known examples of it being recited, even in the present day. And we get down to the Vinayaka, which is much more like the soap opera, much more accessible, because it doesn't deal with performance of puja. It simply deals with the narrative and develops the values, the underlying values, which come out in an extremely clear way. So there's developments here. And the same with Vishnu and Shiva and so forth, and the Devi, the various Devi Puranas as well, have a lot of philosophical content in them, as you well know. Whereas the Devi Mahatmya gets straight to the point, and relates Devi to the three great gods, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. But the Devi Purana, and what's the other big one?
The Devi Bhagavata Purana?
Devi Bhagavata have a more philosophical material in them.
Yeah, this fascinates me. It's in many ways, I see the Devi Mahatmya as encoding a great deal of theological content. It's not just a feminine face of the divine. It's encoding a very different MO, a power structure, a very different theology, but it's doing so in narrative form where it's internalized by the myth makers, by whomever, the rishis, the authors, the myth makers. It's internalized. And I think that is very much, consciously or unconsciously, at the heart of popularizing these narratives. It's disseminating very dense information. And we could do this whether we analyze, you know, Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or what have you in the modern world. It's rendering very dense information in symbolic sort of sound bites for people.
Yes. It makes this theological material accessible. As you say, it renders them into sound bites. I like that. And Star Wars essentially is about cops and robbers, like most American films are. I mean, and I quite like the first three Star Wars movies. I thought were excellent. I haven't seen the other ones. It's not on the same level as Lord of the Rings, which is much more sophisticated.
Of course.
But nonetheless, the same kind of themes, in fact, are still there. The conflict between the family relationship between Luke Skywalker, Darth Vader, and his mother and so forth, who he didn't know, and his sister and so forth, come out, have developed underlying themes which develop, and the same in these Puranic narratives. And when you have a text like the Vinayaka Mahatmya or the other Mahatmyas, then you can develop these themes in a way because they're concentrated. Whereas in the larger, much larger texts, the themes are much more diffuse. The narratives are more diffuse, I should say, and it makes it difficult to develop for a popular audience, I think, to get the sense of what the underlying theology is, even in relation to the much more magical, if you like, or illustrious presentation of action. Because what the Vinayaka Mahatmya does is present action in many ways. And I think that's quite a fundamental aspect of the text.
Could you say a quick word about your actual process translating from the Sanskrit to the English? What's that like for you?
Hard going. No, I've been doing Sanskrit, I don't know, for 40-odd years or longer or something like that, and it's still hard going. And I tend to translate too literally. Some people have different techniques. What I do, I go through the text, do an initial rough translation. The difficult parts I tend to leave aside. Then I'll go back again and do a more careful translation. And if a particular part of the text is found in another text that's been translated, I'll look at the other translation. If there's a translation in another European language, which I know, and there hasn't been in the case of these Ganesha texts, I will always check that translation, whether it's in German or French. But the process is to try and bring out what the Sanskrit, which is very abbreviated, as you rightly know, because it's so highly inflected, and the syntax can be quite difficult, to try and bring that out into readable English, of course, that is transparent to the original, but also you have to translate style. And I think a running, flowing narrative, as the Puranas are, although sometimes they stop in the middle, of course, and take up a new subject, but I think you're not just translating the words, you're translating the narrative style, because the communication occurs through both the words and the particular style. I mean, the Puranic genre is totally different from Dharmashastra, where they're just listing rules and ritual texts and so forth, again, where they're dealing with rules. So I would go through a translation, I would go at least through four or five times, and then hopefully it's always advisable, if you can, to get someone else to read it. And I went through it, through parts of the text with this Sanskrit reading group that I have, and that's helpful because they have different opinions on a particular verses and so forth. But so I start off slowly going through the entire text, and you need to have an understanding of the entire text before you can understand the bits and pieces of it.
Mm, exactly.
Because you have to work out the intention of the composers of the text. Then you go back and forth, and looking at concentrations and repetitions and so forth. And even then, there are parts in this text which I understood. Some of the stuff dealing with tantric stuff I just didn't understand, and recitation of prayers and so forth, mantras and so forth, that I ended up having to take a guess at. And that's the case with a translation from classical languages, and particularly from Sanskrit.
Fascinating. Well, listen, Greg, anytime you want some insight on mantra or tantra from an emic perspective, I'll draw on some lineal training and help you out. But all jokes aside, this it's so fascinating hearing your process. So, you know, I turned out a new translation of the Devi Mahatmya a better part of a year ago, probably. Timeless time, I have no idea, at least 6 months ago. And I'm now finally making the time to go back and tweak it and get it off my desk. And what I need to do is write an introduction. And one of the things I want to stress at the very outset is this, you know, somewhat hyperbolic, but perhaps apt expression that there is no translating from English to Sanskrit. It's always rendering. So I think there is no, very rarely can you directly translate. There's so many variables with any language, even a modern English or French, there are nuances that'll never be conveyed. But Sanskrit to English, it's like you have to render. Like you will read top five translations of the Bhagavad Gita. I currently do a Bhagavad Gita study group every Wednesday night for some of my school audience. And we can't decide on a translation to use because it'll be fine. And then every once in a while, they'll throw in a word that's like, that's clearly laden like piety or they'll throw in a word that'll, you know, sin. And it's like, you can't quite. So for me, I had to get my analytical brain out of the way because I've studied the Devi Mahatmya for a number of years and it's, you know, much of it's been internalized and I just had to let it flow. And now I'm going back to just double check. And I'm in this particular case, we have a very faithful, rigorous, sometimes a tad literal, but we have a very faithful translation by Coburn 30 years ago, which exists. Yep. And so I'm erring on the side of a more fluid, I mean, ghanam vanam, just to my mind, deep, dark forest. I mean, I don't know, it's dark in there, it is deep in there, but deep, dark forest, ghanam vanam, or trying to translate namastase, 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 namo namaha, what do I do? Obeisance, 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 we now bow down. Trying to translate some of the the texture, and it really is there. You have to sacrifice something every time you're rendering something into English or Sanskrit. Something has to be sacrificed, no matter how you slice it. So thank you for sharing on your process. One final question for today. I know we're close to time. What are you working on now? Next, what's next for you?
I've been working on a project that I've been on and off for 15 years, and it's driving me insane. Arguing that the Mahabharata was partly composed because of the material success of early Buddhism. The Buddhists were very good fundraisers, and also they were helped. They raised that when with monasteries and stupas, that they were embedded within local villages and urban areas, and they brought money into the area. And Julia Shaw, an archaeologist at London who's worked at Sanchi, has shown how much they're associated with dam building. And so what I'm trying to argue is that the Mahabharata, which is a text of Brahmins primarily in my view, somehow or other reflects a deep concern that the Brahmins had with the extent to which the Buddhists, apart from Buddhist teachings, the Buddhists were able to commandeer so much financial support from all sorts of areas of society and manifest this in structures, large-scale structures and so forth. And so that on the one hand, the Brahmins are concerned about this and compose this huge narrative. The other point, which is becoming more obvious to me, is the fact that the Brahmins are extremely concerned about their own status and the extent to which the whole notion of what it meant to be a Brahmin had changed quite dramatically from images that we have in late Vedic literature where they're ritualists and so forth. So I've been working on that and looking at archaeological stuff, looking at the economic background, because originally I was trained as an economist, and I've just got to get onto it and finish it, because I've written about a dozen articles on it. It could go forever. And so that's essentially what I'm working on now. What about you?
Fascinating. Meanwhile, I'm in pseudo-retirement. No, what am I working on now? I'm finishing the translation of the Devi Mahatmya. We've just about finished the co-edited volume with Pakamas, where 18 of you included, contributed to the Sanskrit narrative volume. Yep. What else is my desk? There's a couple articles on my desk, one comparing the Devi Mahatmya to the Kerala Bhadrakali Mahatmya with Noor Van Brussels of Ghent. I actually would love to wrap up all of these deadlines so I can dive into a monograph on the Mahabharata that I was hoping to start last year, but the Visions and Revisions volume took up a great deal of writing bandwidth, among other projects as well. And in my particular case, it's the teaching and the counseling that funds everything, and the writing and podcasting, et cetera, is pro bono. And so you've got to pay the bills. But I would love, I have, before I leave this earth, hopefully sooner rather than later, there's a book on the Mahabharata in the works, looking at the Pandavas as the narrative as an allegory in certain ways to Sankhya philosophy, among other things.
Okay.
But there's a Mahabharata book that's been itching to be brought into being. And then not entirely sure academically. I would love to do some creative writing at some point. I think I have a novel in me, but we'll see.
Yes, the Mahabharata is such a rich text, and you can go into it and never come
endlessly
out.
Endlessly gripping. You like, who comes to mind, because I was trained at the University of Toronto before the PhD, and Archie Don comes to mind. I mean, she spent her entire academic life studying quote unquote just the Mahabharata, but I mean there's no just, I mean, it's you spend three decades on the text and you're still convinced you've scratched the surface.
My big guru Madeleine Biardot, she spent about 40 years studying the Mahabharata, and she was my guru.
Brilliant woman. Real flair for narrative. And I think to study narrative Well, you know, the intellectual impulse is different from the creative impulse, absolutely. But to really, really grok narrative, one has to have a flair for story, or at least an appreciation for story, and then engage it with the analytic mind. Fascinating. All right. Well, we'll close for now, but thank you for appearing on the podcast. Hey?
Pleasure. Thanks very much. Okay. See you later, Raj.
Stay on for a minute, Greg. I'll be right with you. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Greg Bailey on a brand new translation, the only English translation of the Vinayaka Mahatmya. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, keep listening, and keep reading the stories of Vinayaka Ganesha. Take care.